The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Entering into this ancient story, this koan, case 23 of the Gateless Gate. This morning I will read a different translation. We've actually heard two different translations. And all of these stories, we inherit these koan stories. Most of them were originally written in Chinese, which is quite a rich language. Many associations with the different characters that are used in writing the words. In this translation by David Hinton, he actually, instead of using the name, so instead of Monk Ming, each name has some meaning. So Ming apparently means lumen, or measurement of light, and the fifth patriarch is called Yellow Plum Mountain. That's what his name and the name of his monastery was. So, case 23, don't think right wrong. The sixth patriarch fled. Lumen, the head monk, pursued him into hidden vast mountains, all the way to the pass. When he saw Lumen approaching, the sixth patriarch threw his robe and bowl on a rock and called out, "This robe is the embodiment of Dharma itself. Is that something to fight over? Go ahead, take it." Lumen struggled to pick it up, but it was like a mountain, utterly immovable. Hesitant and trembling with fear, he said, "I came in search of Dharma, not a robe. You, not yet even a vowed monk, instruct me, open my understanding. Don't think about right answers, don't think about wrong," replied the sixth patriarch. "Right here, in this very moment, what is the original face of head monk Lumen? The face that's been gazing out since the very beginning of things." At that, Lumen had a great awakening. His entire body ran with sweat. In tears, he bowed reverently and asked, "The ancients handed down the secret chi mind, hidden in secret words, but isn't their chi mind more profound still?" "There's nothing secret in what I've told you here today," replied the sixth patriarch. "If you go all the way back to the beginning, illuminate the gaze of your own original face, that is the secret that stays with you always. Though I practiced with the Sangha at Yellow Plum Mountain, I never truly awakened to the gaze of my own original face. But here today, thanks to your lucid instruction, I've taken a drink, and it's like the water itself knows how warm or cold the drink is. In this, someone not yet even a vowed monk has become my teacher. If it's really like this for you, then we share together Yellow Plum Mountain as our teacher. Take care to treasure and nourish your right answer." The gatha. You can't picture it in words. Ah, can't capture it in paint. You can't portray it in praise. Ah, just give up on experience. Gazing out since the beginning, can your original face hide? Even if this world ends in ruin, that you remains unscathed. So, we like head monk Lumen, head monk Ming, have been in hot pursuit of this original face all week. So I'd like to continue the chase here. Where is this? What is this? We join in with Monk Ming, join in with the sixth patriarch, join in with the robe and the bowl, all of us sitting like mountains. And of course, when the earth trembles, the mountains shake. All of us trembling, shaking, doing our best. And all of us like mountains, being slowly undone. Right? The rain and the wind slowly undo the mountain and return the mountain to the sea. Meanwhile, the plates deep and the earth are shifting. This work we are doing here is working with these tectonic plates of the self, the deep substrata that we can glimpse occasionally and we can have theories about, and that we can know for sure when the earth starts to shake, something is happening beyond our power to control. I was so moved and touched last night by Alan's talk, this original face, and talking about how we become conscious of how we have covered over. All of us have constructed selves, and as we've been talking about this 5.5-month-old baby who somehow is crawling around the zendo here, that he is learning, we hope, he and all the other babies in the world, learning how to construct a self, learning how to navigate this world, learning when you play peekaboo, that things stay around. If you leave the ball here, it will stay in one place. Of course, this is quite dependent on conditions. You leave it in a slanted place and you go to look for your ball. Say, well, it was right here a minute ago. Things are supposed to stay where they're put. So we learn this object permanence, and very helpful, so we can do our calendars, so we can live in the world. And then this very thing that has allowed us to live in the world and allowed us to get here, please give thanks to all of your miserable and deluded selves throughout your lives that have gotten you here. Without those poor deluded suckers, you would not have found your way. Each one of our mistakes is necessary for the path. And of course we say this practice of Zen or this being human is one mistake after another. One mistake after another. And so in pursuing this original face, in this question of, well, what is before this self or under this self? As we've explored some in these Dharma dialogues, we have to be so careful because everything splits in two so quickly. And so one of the important parts of practice is really seeing how yourself operates, to see the habitual patterns. Where is it you go again and again? These things that are so invisible because we just live them and we just think, this is not me, this is the world. It's not that I am untrustworthy, the world is untrustworthy. And why can't the world be different? And then I would be happy. If you behave differently, then I will be happy. And we focus so much attention on other people, our partners and our friends, our bosses. Here in the Zendo, we begin to see the root of the problem. The real one who is causing trouble is the one who is sitting on the cushion. And we say again and again, as we sit, this is not self-help. We are not trying to improve or replace the self. Any effort to get rid of the self is a mistake. It's just creating another self. I am the self who has no self. Thank you very much. And then we cling to the pure one, the one who is beyond, who is just another stinky version of the self. After I use the toilet, like roses, right? Not my poop. But then you think, oh, well. But we can delude ourselves. We are masters. The inventiveness of the human mind is truly something to bow down before. We can construct a self out of anything. And so I want to tell you that a good Buddhist self is no different from any other kind of self. Temporarily useful. And we have to appear as something, and that we get to appear, as I think it was Bob talking about, as the ghost reminded us last night, it is so precious to appear in this world. It is so precious to be troubled. I remember Mike once talking about his father when his father was quite ill. And it was in the middle of winter and toward the end of winter, and it was just snowing and snowing. And I was in the place, in the beginning of winter, I'm quite excited about using the snowblower and shoveling, and this is great, and clear the path. And but by February or March, it's like, oh, please, do I have to get up early? And we were talking about this, and Mike said his father, as he was quite ill, when he couldn't get out of bed, when the snow came, said something like, I wish I could go out and shovel the snow. Right? I wish I could have to work hard. And this preciousness of the particularness in which we appear. The teaching is that your miserable karma, this incarnation you have that's so troublesome, and all of our, if you don't think your incarnation is troublesome, please talk to me. Each one of us has such difficulty in this world, and we know this. It is so painful and confusing and clarifies and then gets confusing again. But this miserable karma transforms into your wonderful dharma. So the point is not to get rid of your karma, to transcend it, somehow to be free from it. There is no other life. There is no possibility of exchange. There is this moment appearing, and this moment, the truth of this moment, and this great Satori we hear about is not different from the stuck and complaining place. And so we are trying to see into, in this very moment, not getting stuck in your story of this and that, in this very moment, where is the original self? And original self, also we might say your true self, the one that is not limited. It does remind me, before one retreat, one of the Tenzos was shopping. Actually, the assistant Tenzo was shopping, and the Tenzo gave me the list, and I was supposed to email it to the assistant Tenzo. And so it was, you know, two tins of soy sauce and three thises. And I slipped into the list one true self. So our assistant Tenzo got this list and was looking down, and he got the two tins of soy sauce and the seven cans of beans. And then he came back and he said, "I could not find the one true self." A wonderful moment. But this one true self, Dogen, says the entire body is the true self. The entire universe is the true Dharma body. And so Mike now will explain this true Dharma body. So I loved hearing what the assistant Tenzo thought of this one true self when he first saw it on the list. He said, "Is that a kind of margarine?" and isn't that what we do? What is this one true self that we keep hearing about in the Dharma? That must be the one who is not the one I am. Because I keep hearing that the one I am is the delusion. The one I am is the one who thinks right and thinks wrong. So it can't be that one. I love the chant on the dim and dull one. You are now bearing witness to the dim and dull one. Showing up. And who is this one who is dim and dull? Who is this one who is running through the mountain, through the mountains chasing his true self? Who is this one sitting in the Zendo? Wondering. Who is wondering? They say when you finally realize this, you will laugh. But maybe you won't. Maybe you will cry. Maybe it won't appear like anything special at all. Maybe this one true self will be some achy knees and a breeze blowing through a temple. And of course, the moment we name anything, right, we can make it small. And isn't this the joy of talking Zen? Every word we say somehow complete, and every word we say somehow lacking. Each word, each view, the full presentation. Each word, each view, missing something. You know, the real joy for me of this practice is the looking. Because the content is something that I seem to be utterly unable to orchestrate to fulfill my desires and needs.
sometimes dim and dull, sometimes sharp. Sometimes wide open and expansive, and sometimes closed down and angry. Each of these, a complete Dharma position. Firewood is just firewood. Ash is just ash. When we are firewood, just be firewood. When we are fire, just burn. When we are ash, just scattering into the wind. Each position complete. The mind likes to create something that is more permanent. The mind likes to imagine a self that underlies this changing, infinite set of causes, conditions, manifestations. Wants to pick one and settle down and get married. We imagine that would be nice, and of course it would be utterly useless. How could we possibly function? There is nothing we can hold on to. Whatever idea we have of this self that we will discover, that idea too will pass. Thank goodness. So this is not a reason not to put words into the air. There's nothing to fear in thinking. Go ahead. Think right and wrong. Right is perfectly right. Wrong is perfectly wrong. Emptiness takes care of itself. Everything goes its own way. This magical breeze blowing through the temple. Just this. Thank you. So an opportunity now to explore the Dharma together.
Struck by is the places where this translation poses things as questions that in the other one are statements. There is no place for the true self to hide. Is there a place for the true self to hide? There should be no fighting over this robe. Should we fight over this robe?
Yeah, it's nice that the different nuance of that sort of opening it up. And how does it land differently for you?
I like having less certainty. Feels like less, here's the instruction,
right.
And more, where's the instruction?
Mm. Yeah.
And we can imagine a life lived this way. Can we imagine a life lived this way? We just think, oh, that person, you know how they are. it is, oh, I'm interested in my reactivity around that person. This, then it takes it on me, then I get to practice with it. It's a very subtle shift in a way, but it is, huh, what's going on here that I'm having such a strong reaction? You know, instead of, oh, those people, you know. It's a way of dismissing what is difficult for us in our hearts. And I love what you're pointing out. I actually didn't hear that until you said it. So I think I'm grateful to you. But am I?
I'm not sure this is true, but the door opened during Mike's talk, and I think the ghost has returned. Just
see how we're doing.
Well, and I was thinking about, you know, the breeze this morning, and you referred to it, and a couple of days ago, the heat had actually been turned up, and so the radiator was on, and, you know, same room, and so today, the fresh breezes, yesterday, radiator's on in the middle of summer.
This particular translation felt more personal to me, like it felt more intimate, and I think it's because of the questions. This is occurring to me now, because it's not, it's questions being asked of me. It's not stuck in a book.
Right, right. And I think some of us have heard the one version for a long time. We've heard these words, and that shift, and that openness, and that different interpretation. Yeah, so you feel that too.
Yeah.
And you know, it takes me back to what Mike said about that really what Mike has settled on is the practice is just the looking, right? Mm-hmm. And so these questions keep asking us to look. We ask each other, you know, think about all the questions that we float out here in our Dharma talks and in our dialogue, and it's asking each other, look, just observe. See how it lands for you. And then maybe you'll burst out laughing.
I loved when you said that maybe you won't burst out laughing. Right. Because that, in my experience, there's the full range. Mm-hmm. But it is a turning often, you know, in that moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
The part that stood out to me that translation, and I think a lot of us kind of laughed at it at the end. It was like, don't think right answers, don't think wrong answers, but it ends with, that's the right answer.
Aren't your right answer?
And I noticed that a lot of us were like, what? So yeah, I'd love to hear what you
Well, isn't that what you were talking about the last Dharma dialogue? You know, what do you think about that?
It's kind of just stayed with me. I guess there's the different layers of it. Like, don't think right answer, wrong answer when you ask the question about the robe. Is this the Dharma? And the right answer is to sometimes get beyond what we think is the right answer. Or, you know, it's almost like also when we are so worried about getting it right that we don't actually say what we think, or we don't even allow ourselves to really think about it. Like, it's like, I have to get the answer right. Yeah. What does this person want from me? What is the right answer? Right. Instead of being your true self, being genuine.
I just realized that, you know, the story you told about the assistant Tenzo, it has more layers to it. It's like a koan. He thought it was a kind of margarine, not butter. You know, like a fake version. The true self, though, Right.
It's just butter.
It's butter.
We got it.
I can't believe it's not butter.
That's what that campaign
is about. This right and wrong answer, you know, to add the word answer, who knows what it was in Chinese. David Hinton is a poet himself, the guy who translated it, and I was just reading a commentary on another poem that he translated from Chinese, and there's very little in the Chinese, so every translator adds stuff. And so this guy's adding questions, and, you know, and the right and wrong answer thing, it just reminds me of Doksan, and, you know, when you come in and you have to show up in a certain way so that the teacher will admire you, respect you, be impressed by you. Maybe that's, you know, I don't think everybody has that particular set of...
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Right. And the unbelievable quality of teaching in Zen, that you coming in is the whole thing, and that everything you say and do is interesting, you know, and we might question you on it. And then I know when I was in that position, I was trying to please my teacher, I was trying to do the right thing, and it prevented me for years and years and years and years and years and years of showing up. And I don't know how much of that is related to gender, personality, I don't know. But I know that there was a moment when that stopped happening. Actually, it was a subtle transition. It wasn't a moment. I just noticed more and more comfort in, oh, I drank that water. I know if it's hot or cold. Or in Hinton's translation, I am that water.
Right? The water knows.
The water knows. It's not up to Melissa to know anything. The water knows. The koan knows. The footsteps know. The breath knows. Mm-hmm. So this is a matter of, you know, as Dogen says, taking the inward step. And then coming to Doksan is a challenge. I'm also talking to Janet, but mostly. Because it brings up all of our patterns around authority, and you even have to bow when you come in. And, you know, it's a setup. It's a setup to liberate us from those constrictions.
My first Doksan strategy was to say nothing. I tried that for about 6 years. And then my next strategy was to try to get the teacher to talk.
That's right? A good one.
Because it just didn't seem possible that, you know, this thing about trying to get the right answer, you know, that's how I grew up, that somebody had the answer, and it wasn't about me, it was about trying to show up so that I would do that and get their approval. I also once studied a few times with a Japanese teacher, Sasaki Roshi, and he's quite fierce and was a very destructive teacher in many ways. So not a paragon, but the second time I went, I was really scared. Because we would get up at 3 in the morning. This sleeping till 4:30 is a luxury, you know. And once you leave your room, you do not go back into your room, you know. But I was really scared. And I had this dream that he was very old at that time and that he was sick in the hospital. And I went to him and he put his hand on my head and he blessed me. Mm-hmm. And I told this to my teacher, who said, "Well, that's stupid." He said, "That's not what this is about. This is not about getting somebody else's approval." I was like, whoa. This is not about somebody else telling you how it is. And to me, that's where it's the rightness, when we forget about the right we've learned, we've all been taught, you should be a good boy, you should. Then when we align, it's like, boop. And we can feel it. Oh, this is not something else. This is not, you know, this is a freedom in that moment. Right? No thought of, you know, anything. Yeah.
I thought that the sixth patriarch was pulling a Zen teacher thing on him. You know, don't say right or wrong. Don't think right. Don't think wrong. And then he gets to the end and says, be sure to take good care of your right answer. It's like, zing. Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That whole, you know, contradiction.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Because we.
I'm not the teacher. Let's go talk to our teacher. But,
yeah.
Zing.
Yeah.
Because we can make not right or wrong right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So there is that undercutting.
Yeah.
Oh. I guess briefly then, when we go in front of y'all, we're not really asking, we want a right, wrong answer. But your eyes pierce through, yes, but I don't think you have divination rods. I don't think you have the ability to see precisely what is happening in my skull and therefore precisely deliver an antidote. And even if you could, it probably would not be a very useful instruction unless I stumbled into the dark, because then it would be actually trying to apply it like a tool.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderfully said.
But you're aware of that little longing. I really do want you to be able to see right through me, and I do want you to have a divination rod. And I know you don't, but yeah, I wish you did. Yeah.
And I want you to tell me what to do, please, please, because I'm so lost.
Yeah, give me the right answer.
Yeah.
And the dynamic in you can't settle one way or the other, because you know sometimes the teacher says, you're in the wrong direction. That's only partial. You know, it says no. Rings a bell. You do not understand. So it is really challenging. And we were talking before about these technologies. You know, so Doksan is a way of turning the heat up. Right? The cooking. So turning that up. So Jordan and then...
A comparison that struck me when I heard this translation was this is my first session, and I've noticed this pattern arising where in the morning I have like all this energy. I'm like, hey, I'm just going to sit, I'm going to be okay with whatever happens. And then like I have breakfast and I sit for like the lunch period, and I like develop this theory. I'm like, oh, the true face, I found it, what didn't I see? And I get the next period comes up and I get stressed out and I'm like, oh, it was wrong, I'm so wrong. And then I hear a good encouragement talk and I'm like, well, forget it, I'll just sit somewhere. And there's like little differences, like lunch is different, my theory is different, and it just feels like a translation of the previous day. The same underlying story.
Right.
You're seeing a pattern.
Yeah. Yeah. You know this. For me too, and in especially in beginning retreats, first sesshins, I really saw almost an identical pattern to that. I was searching for the question that I asked is how do I do this? So that's not quite the same koan as you, but I came to a really good answer and I knew how to do it, and then it failed. Whatever it was, because I guess I had some expectation of a particular outcome that I wasn't even fully conscious of. Mm-hmm. And then when it seemed to get met, I would say, oh, I must be doing it right, because here is whatever that was. And then it would fail. And so, you know, one of my favorite quotes is Trungpa's, that we're on the path of disappointment. You know, the expectation not being met is the best teacher.
Great, thank you, John. So it was Jeannie and then Jen.
When we were talking about right and wrong, I just wanted to thank Mike when he and his talk.
I don't think people can hear you at all.
I think in your talk, Mike, you said, please think right and wrong.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to say thank you, because I sort of whoa, and then I got it, you know. Go ahead, and then you'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Right.
Use all your strategies. Yeah. Keep using them. See how they work.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's all the Dharma. And sometimes the mind of right shows up, and it's actually really useful. I mean, we engage in the world, and I mean, if I imagine that my life needs to be, I'm never going to think right or wrong, what am I going to do? How can I live my life? How can I do anything of meaning in the world? How can I help others? And so I have to have some sense of what I believe is good or helpful or right in a situation to be of use and to act on that. And I think that, you know, so to err on one side is a problem, the erring on the side of it doesn't matter, you know, it's all emptiness. And then on the other hand, right, to get really caught in it, if there's not, that's why when it shows up as right, right, this is right, you know, and when it shows up as wrong, it's wrong. But I think there's also in our practice this willingness to look deeply into right and wrong as they arise. So to remain really curious even about the mind of right without trying to get rid of it, and curious about the mind of wrong without needing to get rid of it.
I think some trust in the universe that we're just going to keep getting fine-tuned.
Yeah.
Like it or not.
Yeah.
Well, and this is a topic that comes up endlessly in koans. About, you know, one person does something and the teacher says, right, right, and another, and then he does the same thing for another teacher, wrong, wrong. You know, wait a minute, the other guy said, right. Oh, yes, he was right. You're the one who's wrong. but it's really the, you know, so the instruction is what Mike's really pointing out too. I agree. Whatever is arising is the teaching, including the mind of right and wrong. And I think the other thing you're pointing to that I just want to underline is that this is not a practice of dropping ethics and a sense of what's helpful and what's harmful. That makes monsters. Right? We don't want to do that. And we also don't want to be caught in right and wrong as a framework that's very small. So we want to literally avoid evil and practice good. We also want to see what is the best thing to do in this situation. And then we also have to see this is all a construction. And at first we kind of go flip around from those three views. After a while, it's not such a flipping. It's not so severe. It's like embodied virtuosity is what another translator calls samadhi. Mm-hmm. Embodied virtuosity. Just show up, respond, be present, and take it going back to Doksan. That's what we learn in that technology. When we're ready, you know, also sometimes it's just too much to go to Doksan and we don't put out our cards. We have to honor that too. But when we show up, we have to see what's going on. And at a certain point, the teacher will help when we're ready to kind of open and go, phew, I'm lost. I don't know what I'm doing. When the arrogance drops away, when the fear, because I think arrogance is cover for fear, maybe, when the fear drops away. But first we have to be afraid, and first we have to be arrogant. It's like, it's this amazing teaching. Mm-hmm. Thoroughly afraid, thoroughly arrogant.
Thanks. Janet.
It occurred to me that you guys are nothing like Google Maps at all.
Yes.
You know, when you take a wrong turn, Google Maps is very, it has great equanimity. It says, recalculating. drive 0.3 miles. Yeah. And turn right. When I was in, it was actually downtown Boston. It's the best place to drive. The buildings would not allow me to receive satellite. And so I'm driving along. I'm You've gone for me, I've never been. So I'm looking for a place. Trying to get my daughter to something at Boston University. And after, I should have already done the turn, it says, turn left. And then calculation is late, but after I should have already corrected for that, it says, turn right. And so, it seems like there's a little bit of sort of sending you out on a unicycle and having you find out about which way it's going.
Yeah.
How it works.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're really pointing to this. We somehow believe there's a map out there.
And, that too, yeah.
And that if someone would just tell us, just, you know,
right.
Don't make me uncomfortable, tell me the answer. But I love this. Yeah, we're sending you out on the unicycle of yourself. And sometimes we say, recalculate. And none of us really believe that we actually know. None of us. And we have to again and again discover. Only when we get out there in the place where it's not just about somebody else's approval, not about that, and the koan sort of push us beyond whatever map we have, and practiced us, you know, moment after moment, and in fact our life does, right? Whatever map we've made up, maybe it's about what it used to be, but it's not gonna, you know, like Melissa was saying, it's if you're fixed, or somebody was saying, you're in trouble.
Is this the part of the map where the old maps where it said there be dragons?
Well, actually, that's a great analogy, because what we learn in this on this path is that the world is actually round. And that we're never going to fall off.
Yeah.
But we think we're going to fall off. Yeah. We really do, yeah. Right? We're afraid. And yeah, I'm thinking there are some similarities with Google Maps. One of them is related to what David Kay was saying, that we really, you know, Google Maps has a very tiny little brain. and it really doesn't know everything. It seems to. And the voice is so reassuring. At least my voice. The Google Maps, that is, it belongs to me, not my own voice. But it makes mistakes. In that way, it's like us, right? It misreads the landscape and says, take a left when you really should be taking a right. And this is why, you know, the teacher-student relationship is an interactive one. It's you have to show up fully as much as we have to show up fully. We have more power in the situation, but ultimately things shift around and change because the real power doesn't belong to anybody. And the other way we're like Google Maps, I think, is that we don't say recalculating out loud, but at least I can speak for myself. If somebody's really not getting it and keeps coming in with stuff that feels self-destructive to the person or just off, you know, and my mind was recalculating. Like, how am I going to meet this person? I'm always really fascinated by what will, because every, you may wonder, how do we do it up there? Person after person after person. Well, the thing is, it's not person after person after person, for me anyway. It's this person. And then another person comes in, it's like, whoa, totally different. And then totally different. Sometimes people are working on the same koans, that's still true. Yeah, it's like, whoa, who's this person? It's the questioning again. Who's this person? And who are they now?
And another way we're different from Google Maps. I mean, where are we trying to get to?
You have arrived.
Your destination is right here.
We could put that sensor on the seat so you sit down on the cushion.
And there's always butter.
Always butter.
On that note, you have arrived.
You have arrived.